Well, it's that time of year again. That time of year, in fact, it's been that time of year for a couple of months now, when at the office we begin to receive papers and letters and arguments, sometimes even phone calls, over the question of, you could probably guess it, when to observe the Passover. So every year at this time, at this season, as the Passover season approaches, we do hear these arguments. And they're endless, even though we've answered it endlessly, it seems. And we've done many sermons on the subject, written much material, articles, booklets, etc. It seems that the arguments continue. There are those, of course, who still hold to the old view of many years ago that the original Passover in Egypt was the beginning of the 14th. That is to say that the Passover lamb was killed in the early hours of the 14th day of the first month of Nisan or Abib, and that the children of Israel ate the lamb the same night, that night, the 14th, and then waited a whole day later, and then the Exodus began on the following night. And, of course, there are those who argue for observing the commemoration of Christ's death on the same night. And then there's the late 14th advocates, those who say that since Christ died in the latter part of the 14th, at approximately the same time that the lambs in Jerusalem were being slaughtered, you know, Christ, our sacrifice, died for us, there are those who claim that we should be commemorating his death at about the time of his death, so they take the bread and the wine in the latter part of the 14th, the afternoon of the 14th. And then finally, and usually most of the opposition and the arguments come from the early 15th proponents, those who say that since the original Passover was eaten in the 15th, you know, killed in the late 14th, eaten in the 15th, then we should be observing the New Testament Passover, as they call it, the commemoration of Christ's sacrifice in the 15th. And so we have all of these arguments, and certainly I do not wish to wade through the chronology of details today, just perhaps refer to it, but dwell primarily on a related subject. Of course, we believe that the phrase 14th day of at even refers to the end of the 14th. And we do believe that Passover lamb was killed in the latter part of the 14th day at approximately the same time that Christ, our Passover, died for us, and that then the ancient Passover was eaten in the early 15th. And we have demonstrated in times past through articles and sermons and so forth that that was indeed the case, that does fit the chronological account that we find in the book of Exodus and other passages from the Old Testament. You know, when I think about it and think about the significance of the killing of those lambs on that particular date, and yet I think back at certain arguments that have been made in the past, many years past, about how that the Jews had it all wrong, that they were killing the lambs at the wrong time, that Christ had the Passover in the early hours of the 14th and was setting an example for the disciples to follow, and therefore he was eating at the proper time according to the law of Moses. When I think of that and consider the fact that it seems to have been overlooked that his death should have coincided with the killing of the Passover lambs according to the Mosaic law, when I think about that and think about the fact that it has been stated that Christ's death coincided with an erroneous Passover rather than the true Passover, and that has been stated at certain times, then I can't help but wonder why have the chronological details not been seen by more people before, you know, the last few years. Of course, Mr. Ted Armstrong was teaching this back in 1975. I remember it. It somehow didn't catch on, though. But if you could imagine what it would have been like to have been there, had you been a Jew, perhaps a disciple of John, in the early, or at the time that the disciples were alive on this earth, had you been there and you had seen how they carried the Passover lambs to the temple every year, and how the priests would line up in their courses, and how the lambs would be systematically moved through very quickly and would be killed, and they're talking about an enormous number of lambs, and how that the blood would go down through a drainage system and then go out and apparently could be seen. Had you been there and had seen all the blood flowing at that particular time every year, and then also realized when God called you that you knew at the same time that Jesus Christ, whom perhaps you had heard John the Baptist refer to as the Lamb of God, was on the death stake shedding his life's blood at the same time. Can you imagine the depth of meaning that that would have had for you? So to conclude that that was, the Jews had it all wrong, I've always had a little bit of a problem with that. Well, some who advocate that we observe the commemoration of Christ's death in the 15th point the finger of condemnation at us and say that the only reason that we still do that is that we love tradition more than the revelation of God's Word. But is this true? Or is there a theologically sound reason for commemorating the death of Jesus Christ in the early hours of the 14th? Before we examine what the New Testament says, I would like to call your attention to a couple of passages from the Old Testament, just to point out a couple of details here, a couple of important facts that we need to keep in mind as we progress through this study. In Exodus chapter 12, we find, of course, the Passover institution, the death of the firstborn, and so forth. We all know the story. I won't repeat it. But I'd like to take up the account here, read what it says here, beginning in verse 40. Exodus 12, verse 40, "Now the sojourning of the children of Israel who dwelt in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of the 430 years, even the selfsame day it came to pass, that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt." And notice what it says in verse 42, "It is a night to be much observed unto the Lord for bringing them out from the land of Egypt." We understand that the night to be much observed is identical with the feast of the Passover. That's when the Passover lambs were eaten in that same night. It's to continue to be a night to be much observed. Why? Well, it tells us right here, for bringing them out from the land of Egypt. So the night to be much observed as part of the Passover festival, as part of the Days of Unleavened Bread, was for the purpose of celebrating liberation from Egypt. Now, there are those who say that the only purpose of the night to be much observed was so that the Israelites could eat the Passover lamb. True, they ate the lamb that night. But it tells us right here, that was not the only purpose, just so that was a special time to eat a lamb. No, it was part of the celebration of deliverance from the bondage of Egypt, just as the whole seven-day feast of unleavened bread was a celebration of that liberation. So then, the night to be much observed, or the feast of the Passover, really was a celebration of the beginning of the liberation of Israel from Egypt. Of course, in order to be liberated, they had to get on out from there, didn't they? They had to move. And so the Feast of Unleavened Bread pictures, or it looked back for the Israelites, it looked back and celebrated that movement and that departure from Egypt. So we see clearly then that the Passover feast, from beginning to end, the night to be much observed, really is a celebration of liberation from Egypt. For us, it has obvious meaning. It's a celebration of our deliverance from the bondage of sin. So when people say we can separate the night to be much observed from the Feast of Unleavened Bread, that we don't need the night to be much observed, well, you know, how much we need it is not really the question. The question is, does it have Christian significance? And the answer is absolutely yes. It absolutely does. The same significance that the whole Feast of Unleavened Bread has. In Deuteronomy 16:1, we find evidence of the same truth. Deuteronomy 16, verse 1, God says, "Observe the month of Abib, and keep the Passover unto the Eternal your God. For in the month of Abib, the Lord your God brought you out from the land by night." Now here again you find the Passover connected with the Exodus. And it says that the Lord your God brought you forth out of Egypt by night. Probably really means that when the death angel passed over, when the firstborn in Egypt were struck dead, and by the time word of this got around and the people realized what was going on, then Pharaoh in that night declared that the Israelites were liberated, set free, let the people go, was his decree. It probably does not necessarily mean that they actually started moving that night. It could have been very early in the morning before they actually started traveling. But, you know, God, their liberation technically began that night because that was the night that the Pharaoh said, let the people go. and they were declared free, free from the bondage of Egypt. So the point here, though, is that the Passover is once again connected with the Exodus. You might say the night to be much observed, the Passover feast, was a celebration of the beginning of the Exodus. Okay, now then, with all of that in mind, let's move over to the New Testament, to the book of John. And without going through a lot of scriptures in the Old Testament to prove the chronology of the Passover, or to show that indeed it was eaten in the 15th, I'll just assume that we understand that. I'll refer you to the literature that's already been published. Without wasting or spending a lot of time and going through that, I'd like to go to the book of John, and let's ask the question, does the New Testament agree with the chronological account that we find in the Old Testament? In the book of John, chapter 13, here we find Jesus and his disciples gathered at what is called the Last Supper. This was the night of the 14th, keep that in mind, the night before the Jews normally ate the Passover. John chapter 13, verse 1 says, "Now before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour was come, that he should depart out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own which were in the world, he loved them unto the end. And supper being ended, the devil having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him." So if you read the account through, you see very clearly this was the night of the 14th, the beginning, in the early hours of the 14th. And yet John here says that it was before the feast of the Passover. Now I realize that this doesn't prove anything conclusively, because you always have to ask the question, well, what did he mean by feast of the Passover? Nevertheless, the fact that this supper took place before the feast of the Passover would indicate that whatever John had in mind was something other than what they were doing that night when he's used the word Passover. But there's more evidence as we link the pieces together. Chapter 18, we see that in fact the Jews were observing the Passover, killing the Passover lambs in the latter part of the 14th, eating the lambs in the 15th, just as we understand it. John chapter 18 and beginning in verse 28. "Then led they Jesus from Caiaphas," and in this account, I might mention before reading the passage that he had been taken away. This was the night of his betrayal. He had been taken to Caiaphas, the high priest, and now then, breaking into the thought, "They led Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment," the margin of my Bible says Pilate's house, "and it was very early," or it was early, probably meaning it was very early in the morning. "And they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled," this is talking about the Jews who brought him there, "but that they might eat the Passover." So evidently, these particular Jews had a tradition that if they went into the home of a Gentile or went into the judgment hall that was dominated by Gentile rule or whatever was going on here, evidently they had a tradition that constituted ceremonial defilement, and therefore they wouldn't be able to eat the Passover. Of course, some people argue, well, that's just because they hadn't had time to eat it. They would have eaten it earlier. But that's probably not the case, considering the legalistic nature of those people. But we have more proof, more evidence that the book of John agrees with the Exodus chronology. In chapter 19 and verse 13, now this is after Jesus had been taken to Pilate, and now we're approaching that time when he's actually going to carry his stake out of town and be affixed to it. Chapter 19 and verse 13, "When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus forth and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement," but in the Hebrew, Gabbatha. "And it was the preparation of the Passover, and about the sixth hour. And he said unto the Jews, behold your king." Now, it's important to realize that this is more than merely a chronological account here. John's purpose in inserting such statements as the one we just read is, in fact, theological. Because he's obviously, at least in my mind, it's obvious that he's drawing attention to the fact that this was the very time that the Passover lambs were being prepared. The theological statement would be what? Christ, our Passover, is being prepared at this moment in time. He's being prepared to be put to death, just as the lambs were being assembled or being brought together and apparently being taken to the temple at about this time. So I think it seems rather clear that the chronology of Exodus and at least the book of John agree. And I think it's fair to say that if we had only the Old Testament and the Gospel of John, then there would be very little disagreement and we wouldn't be receiving all these papers year after year at Passover time. There'd be very little disagreement over when the Passover took place. But you see, the problem comes in when we consider the wording of the Synoptic Gospels. Synoptic Gospels being Matthew, Mark, and Luke. When we look at what they say, it seems that they're telling us that Jesus and his disciples observed the Passover a night early. Let's go back and see what they do say in Matthew chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26, first of all, beginning in verse 17. Now the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the disciples came to Jesus, saying unto him, Where wilt thou that we prepare for thee to eat the Passover? It says first day of unleavened bread, or the first of the unleavened bread. In our minds, and of course, as we read in the Old Testament, the first day of unleavened bread is on the 15th. That's the first high day. But you have to keep in mind that these people didn't necessarily go by, technically, by what the Old Testament said. They used the common, ordinary phrases and terms that they were familiar with in that period of time to describe what they meant. And those people, in that time, referred to the 14th as a day of unleavened bread, simply because that was the day that the leavening was finally put out and final preparations were made for the feast, and also it was the day when the Passover lamb was killed. So it was a day of the spring festival. It was considered to be the first day of the spring festival, but not the first high day. You understand that. So this was, in a sense, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, considering the days of unleavened bread as an eight-day feast, including the 14th. And Josephus, I believe, confirms that in that period of time it was thought of, the Feast of Unleavened Bread was considered an eight-day festival. Again, the 14th is not the first high day. It's just considered the first day of the festival because that's when the final preparations for the seven-day feast took place. But anyway, they said, Where will you that we prepare for you to eat the Passover? It sounds to me like they're going to eat the Passover that night, in the early hours of the 14th, rather than the following night, doesn't it? Verse 18, he said, Go to the city to such a man and say unto him, The master says, My time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples. And the disciples said to Jesus, or did as Jesus had appointed them, and they made ready the Passover. You get the clear impression that they were having an early Passover, don't you? And of course, you read the rest of the account, you see very clearly that this was the night during this supper that he called the Passover, that he took the cup and he took the bread and he, of course, instituted the commemoration of his death. The wine and the bread symbolizing his blood and his body. Now let's look at Mark's account. Mark's account. Mark chapter 14, beginning in verse 12, and the first day of unleavened bread, you have the same or similar phrase here, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, when they killed the Passover, doesn't mean that the time of day had arrived when they killed the Passover, it just means that the first day, meaning the 14th, the day that they killed the Passover, they would do that the next afternoon, was about to arrive. His disciples said unto him, Where will you that we go and prepare that you may eat the Passover? So here it is again. You get the idea they're going to have an early Passover. Verse 14, he says, And wheresoever he shall go in, say you to the good man of the house, The master says, Where is the guest chamber where I shall eat the Passover with my disciples? Verse 16, And his disciples went forth and came into the city and found as he had said unto them, and they made ready the Passover. Again, we're talking about the early hours of the 14th. And yet they're talking as if they're going to keep the Passover that night. An early Passover. Finally, in Luke chapter 22. Luke chapter 22, beginning in verse 7. Luke says, "Then came," or the better translation would be, "then came near the day of unleavened bread," meaning the 14th, "when the Passover must be killed." When you read Matthew and Mark's accounts, you get the impression the 14th had already arrived. And yet Luke's account says, "then came near the day." In other words, when you put all the accounts together, they seem to be saying that it was in the right in the latter hours of the 13th, the 14th was about to begin. And so Luke says here the day of unleavened bread that they killed the Passover was drawing near. It was about to begin. I think that's the most logical conclusion we could come to when we consider all three accounts. And he said to Peter and John, saying, "Go and prepare us the Passover that we may eat." There it is again. Verse 11, And you shall say unto the good man of the house, "The master says unto you, where is the guest chamber where I shall eat the Passover with my disciples?" Again, we have it, don't we? And according to the Exodus chronology, the best I can tell, and what John says, the best I can tell, they're a night early. Verse 12, "And he shall show you a large upper room furnished, there make ready. And they went and found as he had said unto them, and they made ready the Passover. And when the hour was come, he sat down and the 12 apostles with him, and he said unto them, with desire I have desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer. For I say unto you, I will not any more eat thereof until it be fulfilled in the kingdom of God." So it seems that either we have a conflict here, or there are a few elements that we're missing, right? And when you consider what is being said here, the fact that he called this meal that they had that night the Passover, and with the understanding that the usual Passover was not eaten until the following night, then you can only conclude, you have to agree that those who advocate commemorating the sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the 15th, that it do have a certain ring of logic in their argument. I mean, you know, the argument essentially says that since Jesus Christ couldn't keep the Passover in its usual time this year because he was going to be dead, then what he did was he showed his disciples how to keep it in the 14th, so that thereafter, in the subsequent years, they could keep it in its proper time. Now, that seems to make sense, doesn't it? Seems to have a sound of logic to it. However, there are some very serious problems with this view. And one of the problems, and we could name a number, but one of the problems is the limitations they place upon the word Passover. You see, we tend to read a word like Passover, and we think in terms of a single, just, you know, apply it to one thing and one thing only. We speak of the Passover, that must be a particular day or a particular observance or one aspect. You know, we tend to be limited. And those who advocate an earlier, or I should say a 15th, commemoration of Christ's sacrifice tend to limit the word just that way. But, and they say furthermore that since Jesus called it the Passover, it must have been the Passover described in Exodus 12 and Leviticus 23, the Passover in which the sacrificial lamb was eaten. But was it? Did Jesus eat the sacrificial lamb that night? Is there any real evidence in the synoptic accounts or any other account that he did? Was this the Passover described in Exodus 12, Leviticus 23? Well, let's notice a couple of things here, just keeping your place there in Luke 22 rather than look back through all the synoptic accounts since they say essentially the same thing. You know, it seems rather curious that the disciples asked about the Passover if they expected to keep it that night. That is to say, the sacrificial lamb. It seems curious, as there they are, the 14th is about to begin, And then they begin, at that point in time, they inquire about, well, where are we going to eat the Passover? Doesn't that seem a little bit curious that they would that late inquire about it? It seems that they would have made plans at least, you know, a few hours earlier or a day earlier or whatever. That's just, that doesn't really prove anything, but it does, it is a curious matter. It's a curious thought, or a question. Another point is, since Jesus had, there are scriptural indications that Jesus did keep the Passover along with the other Jews in the years preceding, meaning that he was there in Jerusalem on the 15th eating the sacrificial lamb along with the rest of his family, and undoubtedly his disciples had done the same thing. Doesn't it strike you as a bit curious that here the disciples were asking about where we're going to have the Passover in the early 14th when they were accustomed to doing it in the late 15th? And there's not a word of explanation. No explanation is offered. No questions are raised. No objections. Doesn't that seem a little bit curious? And another matter that enters into the picture is the fact that we know that Passover, that is to say, the Passover when the sacrificial lamb was eaten, was a family occasion. One could argue, well, this was Jesus' family. His disciples were his family. Well, no, it was a family occasion in that normally families, you know, mothers and brothers and sisters and so forth, got together on this evening, a very meaningful evening to families. Yet there's no mention of Mary, no mention of the wives of the disciples, no mention of the brothers and sisters of Jesus. It's just something that kind of happened rather suddenly. There they were, eating a meal that they were calling the Passover. So you kind of get a few clues here. None of this information is absolutely conclusive, but they do provide some clues that very possibly this was not an early Passover at all. It was simply a meal that was called the Passover. Now, is that believable? Is it conceivable? Well, an important question that is often overlooked is this. Did the terms and the phrases that they used mean precisely the same thing that those same terms and phrases mean to us? And the answer is obviously not. We've already discussed it when we talked about the meaning of this expression, the first day of unleavened bread. To us, that can only mean one thing, the 15th. To them, it meant the day before the 15th. What about the word Passover? Could it have more than the limited meaning that we give to it? The answer is yes. In fact, the sacrificial lamb was called the Passover. I mean, the animal itself. That was called the Passover. The sacrificial rite and the feast that followed, the night to be much observed, was called the Passover. And in fact, the whole festival was called the Passover. All the days of unleavened bread, the Passover. And since the 14th was considered to be one of the days of unleavened bread, we can say, and it's a fact, that the whole eight-day festival was called the Passover. So does it not make sense then that, or does it not at least seem plausible to conclude that the meal that Jesus had that night was called the Passover because it was a Passover meal? It was the first meal of the festival. Yeah, it's plausible. It makes a lot of sense when you consider that, or consider all the facts. So when the synoptic writers spoke of the Passover, they assumed their readers would understand which aspect of the festival they had in mind. They didn't have to say when the day of unleavened bread came, the day they killed the Passover lamb. They didn't have to insert the word lamb. They knew their readers would understand. And apparently the same is true of every other time they use the word Passover. Let's just look through Luke 22 and insert the words lamb and meal in their appropriate places, and I think you can see clearly what I'm talking about. Verse 7, Luke 22, Then came near the day of unleavened bread when the Passover lamb must be killed. See, we inserted the word lamb because we know that's what Luke meant. Verse 11, let's insert another word here now to capture what he very likely, and I'm certain, what he meant. Verse 11, and you shall say unto the good man of the house, the master says unto you, where is the guest chamber where I shall eat the Passover meal with my disciples. Now, this is in agreement with what some of the way some of the modern translations render this, because apparently they recognize that this was a meal. It was not necessarily the sacrificial lamb that was being eaten. And he shall show unto you a large upper room furnished, there make ready. And they went and found as he had said unto them, and they made ready the Passover meal, meaning the first meal of that festival, a seasonal meal, the first meal of the spring festival, which technically or officially in their minds began on the 14th. Verse 15, and he said unto them, with desire I have desired to eat this Passover meal with you before I suffer. So it's very likely, and I think the most plausible, it's most plausible, I personally feel certain of it, that this, he was not talking about the sacrificial lamb at all. He was not talking about the Passover that normally occurred in the 15th. This was a seasonal meal. But he did something that night, and you read about it in each one of these accounts. He did something. It was not necessarily called the Passover, but even though this meal was a Passover meal, he did something that night that we could say was something, he instituted something that was brand new. Something brand new, and it's something the Apostle Paul would later refer to as the Lord's Supper. So really, when you put all the facts together, there's no reason to think that the commemoration of Christ's sacrifice is merely a continuation, a slightly adjusted continuation of the Old Testament Passover, is there? You know, a lot of people think, well, Christ just, he moved it to a new time and changed the symbols. Well, not really. What he did was he instituted something brand new. Something brand new. Let's see what the Apostle Paul said about it. First of all, let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 5. And see that he didn't mind using the word Passover. Let's see how he used it. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 7, he says, purge out therefore the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, as you are unleavened, for even Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. So the Apostle Paul certainly was not afraid to use the word Passover, was he? He obviously knew what it meant. He knew what it had stood for from its institution in Egypt. It foreshadowed Jesus Christ, our Passover. But now, even though he uses the word Passover here, it's interesting that in 1 Corinthians 10 and 11, let's turn there and take a look at some things that he says. It's interesting that he does not use that word when he describes the commemoration of Jesus Christ's sacrifice. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, we will see some words he does use. He says in verse 16, the cup of the blessing which we bless, is it not the communion of the blood of Christ? Communion. You ever wonder where so many churches get communion when they talk about, you know, the bread and the wine? Right here. The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ? He uses the word communion. The word simply means fellowship. And by observing this commemorative occasion, what we're doing and what it really means is we're entering into, or it pictures the fact that we have entered into and our being in fellowship with Jesus Christ. That's what it's really about. That's why he uses the word fellowship or communion. For we being many are one bread and one body, for we are all partakers of that one bread. And then down in verse 21, he says, you cannot drink the cup of the Lord. There's another term he uses, cup of the Lord, and the cup of devils. Meaning you can't engage in idolatrous activity and at the same time drink the cup of the Lord and have it be meaningful to you. You're doing it in vain, in other words. If you're drinking the cup of demons, then if you take the Lord's cup, it's all in vain. That's what he's saying. You cannot be partakers of the Lord's table. There's another expression. It's a very meaningful expression. And of the table of devils. And then over in chapter 11, he uses the term Lord's Supper. chapter 11, beginning in verse 20, he says, "When you come together, therefore, into one place, this is not to eat the Lord's supper. For in eating, everyone takes before the other his own supper, and one is hungry and another is drunken." You know, a lot of people use the argument that Paul, he says here, "When you come together, this is not to eat the Lord's supper. Therefore, you're not supposed to be eating the Lord's supper." A lot of people think, and some of you have heard this argument in the past, that the Corinthians were trying to imitate the Last Supper, and that Paul has come along, he's correcting them and say, "No, you're not supposed to do that. You're only supposed to take the bread and the wine, but not imitate the Last Supper." It's not what he's saying. He is calling the taking of the bread and the wine the Lord's Supper. It's very clear what he means here, because he contrasts Lord's Supper with your own supper. What he's really saying is when you people come together, there is division among you. You know, the rich are sitting over here, and you're neglecting the needs of the poor. You're segregating yourselves. And there is division there, and it ought not be. Why? Because we're one body, partakers of one bread. And therefore, when you come together to partake the Lord's Supper, which pictures our fellowship with Him, and you yourselves are divided in your own fellowship, then you're doing it in vain. You're not eating the Lord's Supper, it's your own supper. That's really what he's saying here. That's the total message. He goes on to say, "Why do we not houses to eat and drink in, or despise you, the church of God, and shame them which have not? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I praise you not. For I have received of the Lord that which also I delivered unto you, that the Lord Jesus, the same night in which he was betrayed, took bread." Now, it's interesting here that he does point out when Christ did it, doesn't he? And some people may argue, well, that doesn't prove we're supposed to do it that same night, which is the 14th. But remember that Paul's, the whole section here is strongly corrective. Very strongly corrective. And had these people been observing the Lord's Supper at some time other than the night in which he was betrayed, by the calendar date, then it's likely they would have taken this as correction, don't you think? And Paul probably knew that he shouldn't mention it if he didn't mean for it to be taken as correction. So it was the night that in which he was betrayed is when he instituted this, verse 24, "And when he had given thanks, he brake it and said, Take, eat, this is my body which is broken for you. This do in remembrance of me," meaning this is a commemorative occasion. A commemorative occasion. "After the same manner also he took the cup when he had supped, saying, This cup is the New Testament in my blood. This do as oft as you drink it," or as many times as you drink it, you know, year after year, in remembrance of me. So this is a commemorative occasion. And what the Apostle Paul here is clearly talking about is fellowship, the fellowship we have with Christ and therefore with each other. You know, the words supper and table, some people say, well, that little sip of wine and a little piece of bread couldn't be, Paul couldn't possibly be talking about that when he said Lord's Supper, because you can't describe that as a supper. That's not what he meant at all. Table and supper and communion, all of these are fellowship terms, and that's what Paul had in mind, not the amount of food that was on the table or that was served at the Lord's Supper. He was thinking in terms of the communion, the fellowship that we have with Christ and therefore with each other. So the Corinthians were not trying to imitate the Last Supper, and this is not what Paul was refuting. He was refuting the fact that they were not in a proper attitude, a proper frame of mind. They were not having the proper approach to the Lord's table and to the Lord's Supper. You know, these terms, supper and table and communion, take on far greater meaning when you understand what Paul says here in its historical context. Once you understand that in that world, the people you ate with were the people you were identified with, then these terms become extremely meaningful. For example, normally a pious Jew did not invite an uncircumcised Gentile to sit at the same table with him. Why? He would be identified with him. And he didn't want that. You remember how the Pharisees condemned Christ for sitting at the table with sinners and publicans? They made an association there. They identified him with them. And normally a master didn't invite his slaves to sit at the same table with him. So can you imagine, can you imagine the enormous significance of a master inviting his slaves to sit down at his table and partake of his supper? You know, in effect, what he's saying is, you're no longer mere slaves. You're more than that. You're my friend. And that is precisely what Jesus Christ said to his servants, the disciples, in the night of his betrayal. And that's what these terms are about. Lord's table, Lord's supper, communion. They're about fellowship with him, and in him we have fellowship with each other. He is not saying, well, you can't eat the Lord's supper. Well, that's a Protestant custom. He's not saying anything of the sort. He's saying because of your approach, what you're calling the Lord's Supper is really not. You're doing it in vain. So the Lord's Supper then pictures our entering into and being in full fellowship with Jesus Christ. It is a Passover of sorts, and I'm quite sure that we'll continue to use the word Passover when we speak of the Lord's Supper. It really doesn't matter. That's okay. But those who think that the commemoration of Christ's sacrifice is a continuum, a precise and exact continuum, only some slight modifications of the Old Testament Passover, and who insist that it be observed in the 15th, are actually missing an extremely important and vital truth. We commemorate an event, as we all know. We commemorate an event on the annual date of the original event, don't we? Just as we said earlier, the people of Israel commemorated their exit, their liberation from Egypt, when that liberation began, the very night that liberation began. So it makes sense then that we would commemorate the sacrifice of Jesus Christ on the date that his sacrifice took place. Now the question, we have three questions before us. Number one is, when did his sacrifice take place? Number two is, what did it involve? And number three, has God called upon us to merely accept that sacrifice or to participate in it? Three vitally important questions. We'll answer the first two by turning to Isaiah 53. Isaiah chapter 53. Where we find the prophecy concerning the suffering servant of God. Of course, it is a messianic prophecy. It's speaking of Jesus Christ and what he would have to endure when he came in the flesh. Isaiah chapter 53, beginning in verse 3. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised and we esteemed him not. Keep in mind, this is all a part of his sacrifice. Some people seem to think that Christ's sacrifice is restricted to that single sliver of time when his bodily organs ceased to function and when his consciousness faded into oblivion. No, his sacrifice involved a lot more than that. And we're reading about it right here in Isaiah 53. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. That's talking about more than the moment of his death, isn't it? Yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted, and he was wounded or bruised for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes or bruises we are healed. Is this talking about just the moment of his death? No, it's talking about his suffering. Talking about his suffering. And when did his suffering begin? In the night of the 14th. That was part of his sacrifice. That was definitely a part of his sacrifice. When he experienced the betrayal of a man who had been among his closest friends for 3.5 years, do you think he was just going through the motions? You think he said, well, now it's time for the betrayal, and kind of robot-like going through the motions? Or was he fully human, and did he have human emotions, and was he stabbed in the very depths of his soul? You bet he was. It was painful. And that was part of his sacrifice. When he had seen Peter a few hours earlier stick out his chest, as it were, and say, "I'll follow you even unto death," and then later hear him deny him three times and curse and probably kick and spit and everything else in denial, when he turned and looked at him when he heard that, do you think that didn't hurt? Do you think his soul wasn't extremely and deeply sorrowful at that moment in time and in great pain? You bet it was. And that was part of his sacrifice. Earlier, when he was in the garden and his sweat was, as it were, great drops of blood, as he cried out to God and said, "My soul is sorrowful even unto death," was he just going through the motions and saying this because it was time to say it, or did he feel it right down into the depths of his being? And was he fearful? Was he afraid for his life? Did he not want to have to face this? He had fear, just like you and I would. He had torment, as he said, "My soul is sorrowful even unto death." And that was all part of his sacrifice. And when they carried him away, and the buffeting that he experienced, the hitting in the face, the pulling of the beard, and when they spat upon him, and mentally and emotionally and physically abused him, was that part of his sacrifice? We just read about it here in Isaiah 53. You bet that was part of his sacrifice. So the sacrifice of Jesus Christ began in the night of the 14th. The same night that he took the bread and he took the wine, he gave it to his disciples and said, "This do in remembrance of me." So how appropriate then that we commemorate his sacrifice in the night that his sacrifice began, just as the children of Israel celebrated their exodus from Egypt in the night their exodus began. It all makes perfectly good sense, doesn't it? And theologically, it is far more sound, I think we would all agree, than the other theories, that is the 15th theory and so on. Now then, the third question, we've answered the when and the what. The third question is, has God called upon us to only accept, you know, believe on him or accept the sacrifice of Christ, or to participate in it? I'd like to link several scriptures together from the New Testament very quickly. And I'd like for us to see the connection that the New Testament writers make between suffering, between our relationship with Christ, Christ our sacrifice, our suffering and his suffering. Philippians chapter 1. Philippians chapter 1 for the first scripture. Let's see what Paul thought about our fellowship with Christ and how his suffering and our suffering relate to each other. Philippians chapter 1, and beginning in verse 27, Paul says, "Only let your conduct be as it becomes the gospel of Christ, that whether I come and see you or else be absent, I may hear of your affairs, that you stand fast in one spirit, with one mind, striving together for the faith of the gospel, and in nothing terrified by your adversaries." They had very real adversaries then, real persecutors. They experienced things you and I have yet to experience. They had people who would, for Christ's name's sake, would do all kinds of terrible things to them. And very real adversaries, undoubtedly some of these people had even laid down their lives, in addition to having previously lost their jobs and other things as a result of their adversaries. He says, "And nothing terrified by your adversaries, which is to them an evident token of perdition, but to you of salvation and that of God. For unto you it is given in the behalf of Christ, not only to believe on him, but also to suffer for his sake." Are we called upon just to believe on him? Are we called upon to bear our cross or our stake? You know what that term meant anciently, that expression? You know, Jesus said, "Take up your stake, your cross, and follow me." That was a commonly used expression among the rabbis and others in that ancient world. It meant simply that it was a one-way trip. You never did see somebody going out of town with a stake on their shoulder to which they were to be attached or impaled and then come back. And you can imagine what kind of unpleasant journey it was. It was a journey involving suffering, a very painful experience. And so Jesus says, take up your stake and follow me. You see how our relationship with him, our fellowship with him, is linked with his suffering, and how that our suffering is linked with his, and the things we may have to endure for his sake. You know, when we're baptized, we participate symbolically in his death, burial, and resurrection. We're participants, not just onlookers, participants. And we're participants in his suffering. Let's look at Philippians chapter 3. Philippians chapter 3, verse 8, Paul says, yea, doubtless, and I count all things but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things, and do count them but dung, that I may win Christ, verse 10, that I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being made conformable unto his death. You see what I'm driving at here? How that that we're called upon to participate in his sacrifice, as well as in his life, in his resurrection, and so forth. Yep, we're participants, not just onlookers. And Paul says that he wants to know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his suffering. Romans chapter 8, one that's very familiar to most of us, chapter 8, verse 15, for you have not received the spirit of bondage again into fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption, whereby we cry, Abba, Father. The Spirit itself bears witness with our spirit that we are the children of God, and if children, then heirs, heirs of God, and joint heirs with Christ, if so be that we suffer with him, that we may be also glorified together. And finally, 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. And beginning in verse 11, Paul says, it is a faithful saying, for if we be dead with him, notice that if we're dead with him, we symbolically participated in his death when we were baptized. We buried the old man, as it were. If we be dead with him, we shall also live with him. We're participants in his resurrection. If we suffer, meaning if we suffer with him for his sake, we shall also reign with him. If we deny him, he will deny us. So the point is, when we enter communion with Jesus Christ, we become participants of his death, his resurrection, and yes, his sufferings. So this year, when we gather at the Lord's table to partake of his supper, let's think deeply of the sufferings that he endured on that fateful evening, and of the agony that he experienced as the weight of our transgressions bore down upon him. And let's remember that we're called upon not only to accept his sacrifice, but to participate in it, that we may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings.